I'm here today at Dirt Time 2014. We're in the hills above Beaumont in California, and I'm speaking with Tony Soares, who's a potter. And Tony just got done teaching a class and showing everybody how to make a traditional pot, the Southwestern style. He had a bucket of clay, and he did the whole pot. It was awesome, Tony. Hey, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me up.
Yeah, you're welcome. Tony, why don't you begin by telling us how you got involved in pottery in the first place and what your background is, and we'll go from there.
All right. My grandmother got me into making pottery. She's an artist and has a little bit of native background, but got me into making pinch pots. She lived in Cypress at the time.
Cypress, California.
Cypress, California.
Now, for those who don't know, what's a pinch pot?
A pinch pot is just a ball of clay that's turned into a pot, or a small coiled stack of coils that you just stack up and scrape and smooth it out into a little pot, and then was able to fire with charcoal or a little bit of sawdust, since my grandpa made a lot of sawdust, so it was something that could be done without a huge fire.
It's one of the things that potters begin with, right?
Correct, yeah. And the basics for all of it. And then living in the desert and of Joshua Tree, you'd see little broken shards laying everywhere when we used to play in the washes and stuff. And just I got into wondering where were they getting their clay. So I started finding my own clay, noticing what kind of tempers were in the clay wall itself, and the commercial clay didn't have that.
How old were you when you got started in all this?
Probably about anywhere 5 to 7 making pinch pots, about 8 or 9 or 10 when I started finding my own clays. And
So it was your natural curiosity that led you to just try to figure out what the old people did in the old days with what was available locally.
Correct, yeah. That, and we'd make bows. We didn't have any TV, so we'd, go rabbit hunting with bows and arrows that we'd make. And I believe I did have the Larry Dean Olson book.
Larry Dean Olson, Outdoor Survival Skills, yeah. My old Bible.
Yeah. And I replicated a lot of stuff that they were doing in there, but nobody around really to teach other than, just do it. Find the easiest way to do it, knife or a hatchet or...
So you don't do just the pottery, like you were saying. You also today do bow making and flint knapping and fire making, I presume.
Yep, and like the Folsom points and the flint knapping, which are the hardest thing to make, and until you've actually tried to make one, they're really difficult to replicate.
Right. Tony had some examples of the Folsom points. I know that I could make one. If you folks don't know what it is, I suggest just get a book on flint knapping. It's a unique style. Apparently it was practiced all over the United States. So in your youth, you saw the river banks or wherever the clay was and just collected it and began experimenting along with your grandmother's assistance?
Yeah, grandma helped me out, and my great aunt, her sister, helped me out a lot with going out and finding stuff and for making getting the raw materials and lake bed clay is what I started out with, and salt and sea clay, and just experimented on what would work and how not to blow it up in the fire. And
so all clays are not alike?
No, some of them are really sandy, easy to heat up. Some of them are real pure, and you got to add stuff to them. And
so when you're out there collecting, is there a field expedient way to tell if you have a good clay or not?
You just do a coil test, pour some water on some clay and work it into a ball, and if it, you could pinch something out of it or roll it into a long coil, you probably have a good clay, but you still have yet to thermal test it.
How do you do that?
Just by heating it up. You can heat it up fast to see if it explodes, heat it up slow, and let it get it red hot, so 1500 degrees, and let it cool down and see what happens if it's exposed to air, or even drop it in the water and see if it shatters.
I see. Basically just testing it.
Testing it. Really push it to the limits and all. And then you can, tinker with your body, a clay body then.
And for somebody who's thinking they want to get into this, how and where would they find a decent clay wherever they happen to be living?
That's a tricky thing. You got to really scout it. Sometimes after rainstorms, if you're walking and you feel the ground squish under your feet, there might be in the desert, under the sand just a little bit, there's decomposed clay, but you can only tell that it's there after a rain.
Well, are there particular types of areas where you will find the most clay, like maybe in a rip cut in a riverbank or something?
Yeah, road cuts, riverbed, you know, river cuts, lake beds, you know, wherever the clay is kind of settled. Or.
And is there a clue visually that you have clay?
Visually is usually either the color or the texture of the clay. If the ground is in the desert, it's almost always dry, so the clay will be crumbly in little chunky pieces, and that's how I tell if there's clay. But
well, for example, where we came today, we're up on a private ranch, I don't know, 4,000 foot elevation or so. We drove up the road, and there's a lot of red in the banks. So what do you make of that?
It looked like good clay, and I'm going to stop by and check it out on my way back down. And it definitely had the crumbly look, had a lot of definite iron-bearing soil, which can sometimes be disastrous in the firing. It can, too much iron can melt down pretty quick. So you just got to test it out. But it looks like good cookpot clay for this area.
Now, in fact, clay is in all soil, right?
Yeah, I think the earth is like 70% clay.
Okay, like 70% clay, but you need like higher than 90% or what to make a good pot?
Well, for soil, you can it can be 30 or 40% clay and a whole bunch of sand and dirt and junk in the clay to make a pot.
Really?
Or you can, if you 70% clay is pretty good, you start getting too much clay, it could be a bad thing. The clay needs to have sand or particulate in there for the moisture to vent out, the heat absorption and cooling, heating and cooling.
So the sand that you're talking about adding, that's what people call the temper.
Temper, it could be sand, it could be powdered pottery, which is really good. A number of different things they put in clay, talcs and different things.
Again, you have to experiment.
Have to experiment. Out here, just sand and clay and water works, though.
Now, I'd like to have you talk us through what you did today, but before we get further along, there is a DVD that you have, which I've watched, and you're in, looks like you're in a cave, and you're showing the whole procedure. It's about an hour. Does the DVD have a name?
Yeah, it's called Native Clays, so it's Native Clays to the Desert here.
And if somebody listening would want to get it, how do they reach you?
I guess you could go for, my email would be T, as in Tony, so it would be TSSOARES41@yahoo.com, or you can also test drive it on Native Clays at YouTube.
Okay, so a little bit's on YouTube. And if you can't reach Tony, contact me. I'll make sure you get in touch with him. So Tony had a table. You had some awesome pots that looked like they came out of a dig somewhere. So you try to make them in the traditional styles. Mm-hmm. And why don't you tell us how you started? I mean, we watched in awe for like an hour and a half, and you built it from scratch. So what was your first step? You had a bucket of clay. So tell us about that, and then tell us how you built it.
So the clay was already processed. Ancient way was done on a metate, or you could slake it down, which I slake all my clay down, take dry clay, mix it with water, pour it through screens, add my temper, and then pour it off into a shallow pit with a cloth so the sand will absorb the moisture and you just catch the clay at the right time. It takes a couple of days, but it works. So that clay was ready to go. I had a form pot, which is a round bottom pot, and the pot is upside down, so I formed this big pancake of clay over another pot. And
now you put a cloth on the old pot first.
Yeah, the cloth kind of keeps the new clay from sticking to the old pot, but they would have used either silty dirt or clay to just like flour on the breadboard back in the day when you're...
So is that... I mean, I hadn't seen that method before, not that I'm a great potter, but before I saw your DVD and watched you work today, was that a method that was used in the past to take an old pot or a gourd or something and mold over it, form over it?
Yeah, it's called a drape method, used all around the world, but it was particularly used right here in Southern California, paddle and anvil pottery technique.
Okay.
And, so then once I got the half of the new pot formed, I let it set up for a while, flip it over into a little shallow dish.
Okay, so just so the person listening grasps this, he took a mold, which was an old pot, put a cloth over it, and then he started paddling the clay around it, so it's in the exact shape of the underbowl, and making it thinner and thinner, and it's really looking like a pot. And that actually looked really simple for a beginner to do.
Yeah, that part's pretty easy, and you could basically once it sets up a little bit, slip it over into a bowl and just clean up the rim, and you'd have a shallow cook pot or a bowl.
So that could in fact be a finished pot at that point.
Depending on how far you drape it down. Then you'd go into adding your coils of clay, paddle and anvil each coil up each time, and then you add another coil. And
so you're adding a coil, you're putting your little paddle in water, mm-hmm. smoothing it out, mm-hmm. and it actually looked really smooth. Now, did your first ones look like what you built today?
My first ones were kind of oblong and tall because they're hard to control. You're fighting gravity, and then once you get the movements down, everything starts to work. But the old pots out here looked a lot like balloons with a small neck on them. They're perfect balloon shape, a lot of volume.
But they were not built with flat bottoms, so you have to set them in something to stand them up, right?
Yeah, they would. In the olden days, they would just kick out a little spot in the sand to set their pot on, or they'd have a yucca fiber ring or something that they could carry it on their head, or in a net. Most likely, a yucca fiber net would be the best way to carry a heavy pot.
Okay, so we flipped the mold, the growing pot over. We put it into some sand. And then you're coiling up, and then eventually it starts to turn into what looks almost like a ball, right?
Yeah.
Is that the hard part?
Yeah, just turning it into a globe is basically, and then as you get up close to the top, you remove the anvil from out of the inside, and then you're just using your fingers as an anvil and paddle up, and then kind of pinch and coil the neck up into a nice, elegant-looking neck.
And that is, it did look elegant, and it was what I presume to be probably the harder part. Because you have to kind of bring that circle tighter and tighter.
Yep. Yeah. As you constrict it down, then everything is being formed basically over your thumb, the curve of your thumb. If you look at it from the tip to the inner part of the knuckle, that is basically the shape of the neck of a pot when it has a little flare to it.
It was almost like the top, let's say like a ball with the top of a Sparklets bottle, the little tip.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not done at that point, then you just finished shaping it. Then what?
Then you could throw some paint on it, let it dry for...
Any kind of paint?
Iron oxide is what I usually use, or manganese dioxide. A little bit of clay mixed in there and water, painted on there. But usually I paint the pots when they're dry. And then and they'll preheat the pots to about 400 or 500 degrees, either in an oven or in a pit. And once they've reached the stage, say, where popcorn will pop, then you can, go ahead and pile on your fuel, whether it be cow chips or oak bark or whatever, wood, and get it going. And some of the paints will turn a different color when the pot is ready to fire, and that's just something that nature provides. So.
And then let's say, it's ready to fire. How do you do that? So the way you do it in the field versus the way you might do it at home?
You would... preheat the ground. So if you have a shallow pit or even a deep pit, you'd build a fire in that and let the coals and the flame die down to where the ground's radiating heat. Then you would set the pot on three little rocks or a couple of sticks, bigger chunks that won't actually light on fire right away, and let the pot kind of heat up slowly, at least to 500 degrees. And then once it reaches that temperature, pile on the wood and light it on fire and let it burn down.
Okay. That's what you do when you're out in the open. You had a unique bit of advice for people if they live in, let's say, Los Angeles or in the city, for making a kiln. Could you repeat that process?
Yeah, that's my urban kiln, which is just a bunch of red bricks that surround the pot or pots. But if you have one medium-sized pot, say the size of a honeydew or something like that, you would leave about 2 inches around that pot. Put a layer of charcoal down, put the pot in there, cover it with charcoal all the way up, and then stack those red bricks like an igloo all the way around.
Covering the top.
Yep, that way it becomes like a little jet kiln.
And you light the charcoal and just let it burn out and get cold?
Yep, just takes at least 12 or 15 hours for that to cool off because the bricks maintain the heat. And, just if you're going to use one of those, don't light it next to the window of your house where you're going to get fumes in the house from the charcoal.
I see. So sometimes they break, I presume. You've fired them and they break on you.
They do break, they crack. Lots of things can go wrong, but just keep trying.
So in the old days, people would have fired them in the open, and then what are they using that particular shape that you were, what is that, does that have a name, by the way, that shape of pot?
They call it an olla.
Olla, okay, that's, and then what were they used for in particular?
A lot of seed storage, you know, out here, and pretty much anywhere the rodents would have taken any food that you try to store, and if you're trying to store food that only grows once a year, that's your dry refrigerator, and you better keep it protected, because you can't just go down to, you know, your local store and buy a bunch of seeds once the rodents have eaten them, they're gone.
So to the store is a verb, not a noun.
Yeah.
And then they put a big cork in the top, or how do they seal it?
Sometimes they were sealed with a rock, or in the deserts they found these balls of desert creosote or greasewood that they'd compact the leaves really tight and then stuff them in there, and that kept a lot of the insects out.
I see, like a cork. And does the creosote have bug-repelling effects?
Kind of a bug-repellent, yeah.
Now, would those have ever been used to store water?
They did use them for water a little bit, but they do, the water does evaporate out of the pot fairly quickly, so, but you know, if you're using a canteen to, you know, go 30, 40 miles, it'll work.
So for a day it might work, but generally at home, for home, it wouldn't be used for water storage.
I wouldn't say for very long periods of time. Within 5 days, the pot being not glazed, the water pretty much evaporates out of the pot. So.
Well, let me ask you, did people ever, is it traditional to ever glaze the pot so they would last longer and hold water?
There were some glaze paints in Mexico and South, lead silica glazes that were used, but glaze paints were used just in designs in the, I guess, on the U.S. side of the border.
But they weren't, the pots themselves really weren't waterproofed in that sense, were they?
No, some bowls were fired black on the inside, so a heavy carbon content would plug up the pores of the, or the porosity of the pot, and that was done in some parts of Arizona, so there'd be a shiny black bowl, and that would keep the water from evaporating as quick.
So when you're doing your teaching, your people are getting a history lesson of how people lived in the old days. I mean, somebody was talking while you were doing your class and your talk about how important containers are for everything. You know, we take it for granted today, but the packs, the bottles, the boxes, the bags, everything. Do you actually teach cooking in some of the pots that you make?
I'm not the greatest cook when it comes to all the stuff from around here, but I could do it. But yeah, it's just like boiling in a cast iron pot.
So you'll stick it right in the fire?
Right in the fire.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Now, pottery isn't your only thing. You were mentioning as you were growing up, you were learning a lot of the other hunting skills too. How did you learn the flint knapping, for example?
Flint knapping, I think some folks that I knew had a little arrowhead collection, and some of them were fake now that I remember back, but the place where we had moved to, there was a previous rock hound that lived there, so there was boulders of obsidian laying around, and I just started breaking them in pieces and chipping on them with a nail and another rock, and anyways, got pretty good at it.
A lot of it just through practice.
Practice, yeah. A lot of.
And do you remember how you learned to make the bows?
Bows were just, we started out with just bent sticks off mulberry trees and desert willows, and we'd have little bow and arrow fights and
basically things
like
you
that.
Just take a twig and you strung it.
Yep.
And your arrow making, of course, you have to have straight shafts. What'd you use for your arrow shafts?
Arrowweed was one of the first.
Called arrowweed?
Yeah, arrowweed and then willow shoots. Also.
Willow, of course, yeah, I've used those.
And some bamboo or cane that we'd find and. Anything that we could, you know, didn't even know about straightening. We just found stuff that was straight.
Right. Well, obviously, when you're hunting, I always told people, you know, you could have a bad bow, but your arrow has to be straight because it's the projectile. It's got to hit its mark. What about some of the other skills that people would have practiced in the old days here in the Southwest? Are there other daily living skills or survival skills that you conduct and teach people?
Yeah, I'll teach a little bit of fire making and a little bit of. Rope making or string making is actually one of the things that people need to know the most, and so you always need to tie something together, whether it's your clothes or your, you know, your shelter. It always needs to be tied together. So I think containers and string making and fire making are probably the first things you need to get a hold of really quick, and then hunting skills and gathering skills.
Counting and gathering. Did you learn these from your grandmother, or did you pick it up along the way?
I've kind of just picked it up along the way. My aunt knew a little bit about harvesting some things, and
I think a lot of people were big with Larry Dean Olson. I mean, we owe him a big debt of gratitude for just the recording of a lot of these skills that he did. He was out of Utah, of course, but it applies to the entire Southwest.
Yep. And I don't even know how I got that book, but it landed in my hands, and it was biblical for me.
Oh yeah, it was awesome for me too. So Tony, if people want to take a class or buy a book or ask you questions, give us your contact data again.
Okay, it'd be tssoares41@yahoo.com.
Cool. And Tony teaches on the reservations. He does private classes there and does public things from time to time. And I had a wonderful experience with him, and with you and your presentation. And if people here in the Southwest, I want you to know, if you have the opportunity, it'll be a great experience for you to do so. You're going to learn a lot and pick up historical skills and practical day-to-day skills. So thanks so much for joining me today, Tony.
Yep, thank you.
All right, we'll see you all later.
All right.